Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up.
A trans girl is a girl. She should have the same rights as cis girls.
But a lot of the time people know better and they're actually weaponizing ignorance. Now I'm almost finding myself like on the side of fighting for women's sports. And the organization of the groups that were opposed to our eventual guidelines was immense.
So welcome to another episode of The Real Science of Sport. My name is Mike Finch, and as usual, I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. And today we've got a really nice, juicy subject to get our heads around a little bit, something that's been in the news in the last couple of weeks, and that is the controversy around transgender athletes in sport. Now, just as a bit of a disclaimer, we have done something on this before. I think it was kind of late last year, 2020. But it's become a bigger story, literally, in the last couple of weeks more than it ever has. And of course, as we head towards a possible Olympics in Tokyo in a couple of months' time, it is becoming an even bigger topic. And the reason why it's becoming a big topic is two significant things have happened. One of them is that a New Zealand weightlifter who is a transgender athlete looks likely, although we still don't know, to be picked for the Olympic team. Therefore, that could affect the outcome of whatever that competition results are. And of course, the most famous transgender athlete, and I say athlete because Bruce Jenner used to be a very, very good athlete as a multiple Olympic champion and world record holder in decathlon. Now, Caitlyn Jenner, and he's come out in supporting the fact that transgender athletes shouldn't be competing in sports. So, Ross, just explain to us, first of all, the New Zealand weightlifter. Why is that particularly significant for this time right now?
Because that would be the first case of a transgender woman participating, well, a known transgender woman participating in the Olympic Games. And people in this area have had their eye on Hubbard for about 3 or 4 years now, because formerly Gavin Hubbard, now Laurel Hubbard, having transitioned in her mid-30s, has been a successful regional weightlifter, so competing for New Zealand in competitions in the Pacific Games, for instance, and winning medals there, gold medals. There's a very famous photograph, actually, of a medal ceremony where Hubbard is on the top step and two Samoan weightlifters on either side in second and third, and they actually turn away in a sort of silent, stoic protest against her there. So that was an issue. I remember she participated in the Commonwealth Games, got an injury there, became a headline then. But obviously, the Olympics being this massive stage, it will become a more massive issue than it ever has been. And of course, we'll get into this in this podcast, as we have done before. The questions are around advantage, unfair advantage, retention of male advantage, even after transition. And unfortunately for Hubbard, and I say that because ideally you would have this debate without there being an athlete to look at as an example of it. But that's not going to happen. And unfortunately for Hubbard, it's going to be her who is the athlete in the spotlight. I'd prefer not to speak about a specific athlete, but that's...
Yeah.
In fact, it will become one of the 3 to 5 big headlines if the Olympics goes ahead, is how does New Zealand, because she'll be... You said in your intro, she's now qualified to participate. All that remains is for her to be selected by the New Zealand Olympic Committee. If they do make that selection, then it will open up a whole can of worms. Yeah. So that was the big story there. I think everyone knew it was likely to happen, and now it may be very much in the front of our minds.
Well, let's just take a small step back. For those of you that are not quite clear what we mean by a transgender athlete, let's just define what a transgender person is, and in the context of sport, what does that mean?
Yeah, so we'll stick to sport because there are obviously, I mean, you've said there are two big things happening. There are things happening literally daily around the world in this area. The Australian government is having debates about it. There are court cases in the US and the UK. not necessarily even linked to sports. Sweden has announced changes to how it treats children with respect to transgender medicine and the ethics thereof. So there's always this stuff going on.
What are they doing there specifically?
Well, there was a big court case, the Keira Bell court case in the UK, where one of the highest courts in the UK said that medical practitioners have to be very careful about hormone replacement therapy in minors because they cannot make an informed choice at that point. So they cannot reliably give consent. And Sweden, in response to that, said that they will no longer do hormone replacement therapy in children younger than 16. So, and then in the States, they've gone with similar things. They've been called anti-trans bills. It's honestly impossible to keep track of all the stuff that's going on. So we'll focus on the sport. And I guess for the purposes of sport, the bigger issue is transgender women. So this is someone who is male at birth and who then grows up as a boy, becomes a man, assuming they go through puberty, and that the reassignment doesn't happen before that. But then at some point in life, because of gender dysphoria, where they feel that their gender, which is the social construct, do I identify myself as a man or a woman, differs from the biological sex, I'm male or female. So then what happens is you can now make a transition. And so in the case of Laurel Hubbard, that was done in her mid-30s, and she now lives every day and identifies as legally recognized as a woman, having been born male.
Yeah.
Now, there is such a thing as transgender male, or man rather, where you are born female, and then you can take testosterone to develop, to transition into being a man if you identify like that. That's less of a concern for sport because there's no question really there of an unfair advantage, unless, of course, you want to participate in women's sport. But we'll assume that you want to participate where you identify.
So we're kind of doing our homework here. So when we talk about gender versus sex, that's always the big debate. Just define gender versus sex because it's important in this context.
It's one of the key ones, and we'll play in a clip in a moment where you'll see that mistake made. Is gender is a social construct. It's how you identify. And I remember as far back as 2009 getting involved in this debate because it's relevant when you talk about Caster Semenya. And I remember kind of settling on this idea. It's like you don't tell anyone gender. They tell you what their gender is. So if you identify as a man or a woman, then that's gender. And yeah, there's dozens of them now. Sex is different. Sex is biological. And so people argue this all the time. They say, well, no, there's no such thing as binary sex. But biologically there is. You're male or female. And it has to do with the size of your gametes. Your males produce sperm. Females produce egg. That's a characteristic in all living organisms.
Yeah.
And that is what is identified in literally, with the exception of one in maybe 10,000, 100,000 cases at birth by a doctor. Congratulations, Mr. Finch, it's a girl. That's a biological sex issue. And so it pertains, there are primary sex characteristics, there are secondary sex characteristics, primary being reproductive function, secondary sex characteristics being the things that emerge during puberty. And they would include, for instance, deepening of the voice, hair growth, irrelevant to sport. But they also include increased muscle size, strength, and mass, different development of the skeleton, increased heart and lung size, differences in the tendons, and differences lower body fat percentage. Those are very much relevant to sport. And so any parent listening to this, in fact, any person with two eyes can see how puberty changes us. And that is a function of biological sex. It doesn't always work. You get DSDs, differences of sex development, the Caster Semenya thing. But for the most part, biological sex is the reason for separation into categories for sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to give us a lot of the listeners who don't know what you do in your day job, just not forget that we sit here, we're doing these podcasts and they're sort of an aside to what our day jobs are. You've been very involved in world rugby for the last 2 or 3 years now. One of the things that you've been involved with is establishing guidelines for transgender athletes in a sport which is arguably one of the most affected by this.
Yeah, and so in 2020, beginning of the year, we launched a big project to relook at our guidelines because evidence was emerging. And we'll get into this again later in this podcast. There was evidence coming out that the lowering of testosterone, which is what transgender regulations by the Olympic Committee typically prescribed. You've got to lower your testosterone in order to be eligible for women's sport, was almost completely ineffective at taking away the biological differences between males and females. Now,
just explain why that is. Why does lowering testosterone not have the desired effect in terms of just physical attributes?
Because once the testosterone has done its thing in terms of muscle mass and size and skeleton and so on, taking it away doesn't necessarily remove what it did in a symmetrical way. So depending on which system, physiological system you look at, the degree of change varies from zero, things you cannot change like height, all the way to complete for things like hemoglobin levels. So we'll start on that end. When you suppress someone's testosterone levels, their hemoglobin concentration, that's the red blood cell, that's the compound that carries the oxygen. It's really important, obviously, for endurance performance in sport. That diminishes very quickly. This has been shown in studies. It came up to some degree also in the CAS hearings, not necessarily with trans athletes, but with athletes with DSDs. So hemoglobin levels return to female levels almost, not immediately, but very quickly after testosterone's lowered. So In that one, at least, you can say, that the testosterone suppression does its job. It takes away male advantage. But when you look at things like muscle mass, lean mass, body fat percentage, muscle strength, and power, there is as yet no evidence that lowering testosterone takes them away, and fairly good evidence that it only makes a very small dent in the original advantage between male and female. So if we were to assess whether we compare elite male and female Olympic athletes, whether we compare typical male to typical female or recreational high school level to high school level, there is about a 30 to 40% strength difference between male and female. There's about a 30% difference in power and between a 10 and 15% difference in running speed. The suppression of testosterone has been shown to remove only about a fifth of that advantage, at most.
Wow.
So in the studies that came out towards the end of 2019, which really triggered World Rugby to look at this, it was a study done out of Sweden, they found between 0 and 5% loss in muscle mass, about a 4 to 5% loss in muscle strength measured in transgender women 12 months after starting testosterone suppression. So what you have is a initial advantage of X, and a reduction in that biological advantage that is much less than X. And so the only conclusion you can make is that in these athletes, there must be some, not athletes, we'll get to that as a limitation. In these individuals, there must be some retention of the biological difference that creates the advantage. Mm. Therefore, there is retention of advantage. And on that basis, sport cannot ensure fairness and inclusion at the same time, that you cannot achieve that balance. And for rugby, as you alluded to, we also have a third imperative to think about, and that's safety. So if speed, power, bulk, strength were crucial determinants of fairness, they're also crucial predictors of safety in the sense that a massive imbalance would be like me being tackled by a 120-kilogram professional rugby player, nobody's idea of a good day out. And so we made the decision that because we couldn't balance them, we had to rank them, and we established what was effectively a prioritization. We said, of those three things, what is the core number one priority? And the answer was welfare. Yeah. And so for that reason, we regulate women's rugby to say that if you are biologically male and if you have benefited, and I use the word benefited in the sporting sense, if you have benefited from testosterone during development, you cannot participate in women's rugby. And of course, that was massively controversial. It came out in October last year. It still is controversial now. I mean, there's many unions that haven't gone with it because there's so much social pressure to still include. And this is a very volatile, hostile issue where I think you have good faith scientific arguments on one side, good faith inclusion arguments on the other side, but a whole lot of bad faith stuff happening in between, and it's made it very difficult to debate in a sensible way.
Well, I don't want to say this is bad faith, but it certainly came out at a time when this controversy is becoming, bigger and bigger in the world of sport. And I think across the general sort of talking points around fairness around these issues. And The reason why I'm saying that is that a couple of weeks ago, Sarah Silverman, who's an American comedian, came out with a, I think it was a podcast, and this is what she said.
I saw Caitlyn Jenner saying trans girls should not play girls' sports. Caitlyn, you're a woman, right? A trans girl is a girl. She should have the same rights as cis girls. If you think a trans girl, what, you think a trans girl is too strong? What about tall girls as opposed to short girls? What about boys in high school who are teeny tiny and their teammates have already hit puberty and are shaving? Why don't you just have co-ed sports divided by weight or height? This is so dumb. They are legislating this shit without one single example of how this plays out. This is not worrying about girls' sports. Believe me, not. I think there are better ways to worry about girls' sports. This is not worrying about. This is not what that is. This is not worrying. This is not concern for girls' sports. It's transphobia, full stop.
So there we have it. A comedian, Sarah Silverman. I guess what's frustrating in that situation when you listen to those sort of things is that obviously she's very well known in the States. She's a big celebrity and she's, you know, does a podcast and lots of stand-up stuff. So people kind of believe what she says because it sounds very current and very woke and all those sort of different things. But I think when I listen to that, there's this frustration because you and I have chatted about this on previous podcasts around these issues. And there's so much naivety in that and so much stuff in there that you go, you just don't get it. I think that's frustration about these sort of things.
Yeah, it frustrates me as well. I mean, you can imagine when you've spent hours or weeks, months even of your life thinking about the issues, and then someone literally in 35 seconds, she lists about five basic misconceptions or illogical arguments one by one. And I see this a lot on Twitter because often I get tagged into these debates where the same talking points are raised. And it is frustrating. It's also, it's an unhappy sort of side effect of the fact that sport, one of the beauties of sport is that everyone can have an opinion. So, you know, you and I can watch cycling and you can predict that Pogacar is going to win and I can say Roglic will win. And then there's a little bit of tension between us. And that's what makes the thing actually appealing. Fans will argue about team selection and tactics, and then they'll all scream at the referee and someone else will say, no, the ref got it right. So the polarization of opinion actually fuels sport.
Yeah,
but then you get something like this where there is a minimum amount of expertise and consideration you have before you wade into it. But nobody even thinks twice. And so they just shoot from the hip, they shoot blindly, and these types of things gain momentum. Now, I can laugh off Sarah Silverman doing it because she is a comedian. No offense to comedians. But what's happened in the last sort of 18 months especially is that a number of scientists and people who actually do and should know better have pushed the same arguments. And then that's when it becomes bad faith. Because often you'll see the same thing being said, but sometimes it's just incompetence or ignorance. But a lot of the time people know better and they're actually weaponizing ignorance. and that's where it gets particularly frustrating. And I, you know, just to make the listeners clear, 8-9 years ago, I would have sided with Silverman. I wouldn't have done it that way, heaven forbid. But I hadn't looked up enough. And so my impression was that the lowering of testosterone takes the advantage away. And so therefore, happy day, society can include trans athletes into sport and everyone's going to be happy. There's a good, reasonable compromise. The more you read up on it, the more you realize that that simply is not possible. And then you have to change your opinion. I did. And so it's... Yeah, so now I'm almost finding myself like on the side of fighting for women's sports because people who should have known better at first didn't.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess to some extent she also represents a huge part of society that believes what she says and a lot of ignorance that's involved in that. So it's important to recognize that she has a voice that is probably quite a popular voice.
If I haven't heard someone say, what about tall girls, 100 times in the last year, I'd be surprised. If someone said, why don't we do sport by height and weight, like she said there, 50 times. I mean, I could write those arguments in my sleep because we've had to use them so often. Those are such popular rebuttals, and they are all equally lightweight.
And they're quite inflammatory as well, so they work quite well on social media, don't they?
Yeah, and it's much, that's the thing about social media, it's much harder to refute a basic misunderstanding or misconception. Because you can come up with a slogan and it fits into a tweet, but the response to the slogan is 30 tweets and no one reads them.
Well, talking about slogans, she does actually say trans girl. I mean, we're not that we want to pick this thing apart, but I think looking at what she's, well, we are going to pick it apart.
I'm quite happy to pick it apart. And I hope listeners will also then use these next time they encounter it, because this is the stuff that it's frustrating. We have to correct it.
Yeah, exactly. So that we are going to pick it apart. And the reason why we're doing that is to help people understand why a lot of what she says is so wrong. So let's start with one of the opening statements that she makes. A trans girl is a girl. A bit of a classic sort of statement of fact, which isn't true.
Hashtag trans women are women. We heard that a lot when we held. So the way World Rugby did it, we held a workshop where we invited people from both sides of the debate, and they included medical, legal, scientific, and activists. And we heard this quite a lot, and especially in response: trans women are women. Let them compete as women. And this is fundamental to the debate, because when you say a trans woman is a woman or a trans girl is a girl, I would be quite happy, and I think most people in decent civil society would be quite happy with accepting that in a gender context. So there should be no problem with how a person identifies and lives their life in whatever gender identity they wish to. No worries at all. But the moment that gender identity puts them in a situation where they're going to insert themselves into a space that may have very necessary reasons for separation, then it becomes a colliding rights issue. Because my right to identify as a girl might actually have consequences for your right to compete in women's sports, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So what I think Silverman misunderstands, and I don't think many people think about, is that sometimes self-identity can happen and there's no issue at all. Like, leave people, do their own thing. It doesn't affect anyone. But when it does, then we have to have a reasonable conversation about whether it affects those people in a reasonable way. Mm. And that's the group of people who've been neglected in this discussion, is that nobody was taking the fight up for women, biological females, who have got, and this is what we can explore, have got a right to a space in sport where they are protected against male advantage.
Yeah.
Now, we can get into that in a moment in response to some of the other things that Silverman says. But if you only consider this from the perspective of trans individuals, then you can say a trans girl is a girl and leave it. If you recognize that women's sport exists for necessary reasons, you can then say a trans girl is a girl and a trans woman is a woman. But that is not sufficient to let you into the space, because there are reasons other than identity that should allow you into it. And that's the key point that she misses right from the start.
Yeah. And she goes on to say she should have the same rights as CIS girls.
So, cis girls.
Yeah, cis girls.
Yeah. So,
cis girls being...
Yeah.
What's the acronym for?
Cis and trans are Latin words. Cis means same. Trans same, means across.
Yeah. Okay.
And so cis means that your sex and gender are aligned. So you were born female and you live as a girl.
Right.
Or woman. So yes, and again, like, I don't think decent people would deny people basic rights. But this is a question about sports, and the question should be, very specifically, do you have the right to compete in women's sport if you identify as a woman? Yes or no? And to understand that, you've got to understand why women's sport exists and whether identity is the reason for it or not. And so again, it's the same issue we've just spoken about. There are some places in society where women's spaces should be protected. Sport is one of them. There are others: prisons, rape counseling centers, and so on, medicine, potentially. There are very distinct biological and physical reasons why it makes sense to have spaces that are exclusive for females, biological females.
Yeah.
There are also, by the way, ethical reasons for this. You would know that in the 1928 Olympics, women ran the 800, and some of them collapsed at the finish line, and they said women are not strong enough and tough enough for this event. They cannot do it. And it was 1984. I mean, that's in our lifetimes that the first marathon for women was held in the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
I saw the other day that they're going to have a Tour de France for women in 2022. So nobody in their right minds would say that women's sport and men's sport are equal. It's very clear that women's sport has been held back in the past. So you could argue ethically that women's sport should actually be prioritized, but at the very least, it should be equal. And the only way you can achieve equality in women's sport is to separate it from men, male, and the male advantage. And if you separate it, you must protect that boundary. That's the key here.
Yeah, very important part of that discussion. So, I mean, she goes into the old chestnut saying, what about boys whose teammates, you think a trans girl is too strong, what about tall girls? And you mentioned a little bit about this before we started getting to the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, so many times, tall people have advantages in basketball. Yes, they do, but that's what sport is looking for. So here's the paradox, and like we'll do this, I'll ask you some questions for change. When you're watching the Giro over the weekend and Egan Bernal wins the stage and takes the pink jersey, why is he celebrated?
Well, he's certainly the best rider of the day.
Right.
Yeah.
And the race so far.
Yeah.
And let's assume, okay, lots can change. There's 2 weeks to go. But he'll make it to Milan and he'll be in pink and he'll be celebrated as the Giro winner. Mm-hmm. A few months ago, we watched some of the Flanders races and we see Mathieu van der Poel or Van Aert or Pidcock, whoever, getting celebrated. Why do we celebrate them? Because they've shown they're the best. Now, the question is, why are they the best?
Well, they're the best in their category.
But why? What made them the best?
Pushing me here, because they are physiologically, they have an advantage. They might have an advantage in terms of their development and the opportunities they had when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a mental advantage they have in terms of being able to have big match temperament compared to other athletes.
So all those things, but we'll pick up the first of those, physiological advantages. Mm. This is like a test, seeing as you've hosted the show with me now for almost 2 years.
Oh, the pressure.
Give me two physiological advantages that make someone a great cyclist.
Your muscle strength, so your lean muscle mass must be an advantage, and I'd imagine your cardiovascular system.
So we can call that VO2 max, for instance. We've all heard this term.
Yeah. So how much red blood cells I have in my blood will make me better at endurance events, for instance.
So that's a third one now.
That's
a third one.
Okay.
So anyway, this is somewhat long-winded. I apologize, listeners. But we're getting to the point here is that when we celebrate a champion athlete, we are celebrating excellence by finding through sport people who possess attributes that others do not have. That's it. Mm. So when we watch Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal playing in the final of the Rome Masters last night, we're seeing two people who possess strength, speed, coordination, agility. Mental factors are also there, though harder to measure, obviously. Same thing when we watch cycling, when we watch running, and there's a 202 marathon at the weekend in Milan. Like, we're looking at a definable, if not always knowable, set of physiological characteristics. That's the key, and sport is trying to find them. Height is one of them. Like, there's no doubt that if you are tall, there are some sports that you're predisposed to be better at. But now let me ask you this. When you watch Annemiek van Vleuten win a classic, when you watch Naomi Osaka win a Grand Slam tennis event, or when you watch Katie Ledecky win an Olympic swimming gold medal, are you looking for anything different compared to the men?
Well, you're looking, I mean, obviously all of those athletes within those categories have, like Osaka would have in a category because, well, she's not a category, but she's obviously taller, so she has some physical advantage. But within those sports, she will have an advantage. And I guess basketball players will be largely taller. And I guess also tennis players will be largely taller, though not always.
And Van Vleuten, similarly, will have a high VO2 max.
Yeah.
She'll have that lean and mass advantage. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly the key. So when we reward excellence in sport, we are using sport as a way to filter out those people who possess an attribute or a combination of attributes that sets them apart from their peers. It's all about looking for quote-unquote unfair advantages. But if we had one race and Mathieu van der Poel had to race with Annemiek van Vleuten, you would never see her in the race. She'd be gone off the back, finishing half an hour later than he would be. If you let Osaka play in the same tennis tournament as the men, she would not make it out of the first round. She would not make it out of the qualifiers. So the key point I'm trying to get across here is that there's a paradox in sport. We are looking for unfair advantages. We're looking to find people who are exclusive, who are excellent, who are in a distinct minority, and we're going to reward them for those attributes. But we're trying through sport to reward both male and female for the same attributes. Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce and Usain Bolt are the same human beings with respect to sprinting. They have the same metabolic excellence, neuromuscular uniqueness, if you wish, that makes them Olympic champions. Yet one of them is 12% faster than the other one. And that's the difference that categories filters out.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Otherwise, you'd literally have to have a category for short people, tall people, people with long feet and swimming versus people with short feet and swimming, all that sort of thing.
18 categories, because who knows how many of those biological and physiological attributes make up swimming performance? There could be 50.
Mm.
So assuming you could measure all of them and then filter out, in theory, you could actually have 18 Olympic champions.
Yeah.
But that's not what sport's doing. It's actually intended to reward Michael Phelps, who possesses more than any other human being ever, a combination. But this reductionism nonsense of like, oh, it must be his big feet. There are many people with bigger feet than Phelps who don't swim well.
That's the point.
There are many people with long arms and Michael Phelps's physique who haven't been great swimmers. He's got that plus a dozen other things. But then the thing is, and this is what these folk never think about, is does Katie Ledecky not have them too? Of course she does. She's got the same things that swimming is intended to recognize, find, and reward. In the same way that Van Vleuten has got the same physiological characteristics that the best male cyclists have got, and the sport has to identify and reward her for having them. And if we didn't have a women's sports category, we would no longer have the opportunities to recognize half the world's population in sport.
Yeah.
So when Sarah Silverman says, what about tall girls? The answer is, what about them? There's a space for them. There are plenty of tall women in the world. None of them have ever played in the men's NBA.
Yeah.
There are plenty of tall women in the women's NBA because that's what that sport is meant to recognize, among other things. So what about tall girls? Nothing. There's no category for them. It's not a protected class. There's no protected class for short people. And in actual fact, we celebrate someone who possesses height plus all the other elements of athleticism. But if we didn't do that within a women's category, the sport would have no meaning, because a factor that overwhelms all the others would dominate. Last analogy is, boxing has got weight categories.
Mm-hmm.
Because all other things being equal, the heavier fighter wins.
Yeah.
That's why these guys literally dehydrate and push themselves into seriously unhealthy states to make weight the day before, and then they regain that weight. Because they know that the lower they can fight, the better off they'll be. Because even a 2 kilogram difference to a 65 kilogram boxer is so important in that sport that it actually becomes decisive. So if you didn't have weight categories, boxing would no longer reward balance, strength, speed, footwork, technique, timing, coordination, and endurance. It would still have elements of those, but it would reward strength and power so much more that it would actually overwhelm the sport, and that would become the predominant thing. And that's why female sport exists, is because the benefits of androgens, testosterone during development, makes such a massive difference that if you don't filter out that benefit, they overwhelm every single sport basically that we play.
She mentions also, what about boys whose teammates have hit puberty? Is it the same argument?
It's exactly the same argument. And even there, like, that's a timing thing. And there are people whose lives' work is dedicated to understanding differences in maturation. I mean, we've spoken in this podcast about talent, and coaches often pick early developers instead of late because they confuse maturity with ability. So people understand that, they know that. But that, there's no category. In fact, there is a category for that. That's the reason we don't let 16-year-olds and 13-year-olds play together.
Yeah.
Because we know that, in fact, even 15 to 14, a 15-year-old, all things being equal, will beat a 14-year-old. So if they ever did compete, because we're going to inch towards this argument, if we ever did have a small boxer fight a big one and beat him, that small boxer would have to be absolutely exceptional.
Mm.
In the same way that if you had a good male cyclist lose to a female cyclist, that female cyclist is world class.
But there are lots of very good female cyclists who will beat plenty of male cyclists.
Exactly. So there is overlap in performance.
Of course. Yeah.
There is huge overlap. In fact, I would venture to say that the best women cyclists beat 99% of men.
Yeah, yes.
By quite a lot. I mean, handily, you'd be hammered.
Yeah.
But the best men are 10 to 15% better than the best women, and that's the group that matters. Or typical male versus typical female. Best high school, that's a difference. So the overlap argument is irrelevant, and so is this, what about tall, short, small, teeny weeny boys, whatever.
Well, she talks about height. Why don't we have separate categories for height and weight? I mean, it's all the same stuff. Which
it's all the same theme. Yeah. We have categories for weight in boxing, judo, martial arts, combat sports.
Yeah,
but we would never in our lives dream of letting a 68-kilogram male fight in the woman's 68-kilogram category. Yeah. Why? Because even when you correct for mass, males retain a massive strength, power, speed, and endurance advantage compared to women. You know, the punch power difference between male and female is about 160%.
Wow.
Okay. It is an enormous difference. Mm. And weightlifting,
just because of lean muscle mass, essentially, general strength.
Lean muscle mass, nervous system adaptations, and then there's differences within the muscle that create power that the male can generate that the woman cannot. And so, you know, I may be laboring the point, but so many people get this wrong that maybe it's worth laboring. Is if weightlifting, for instance, Hubbard's event, at the same weight category, because they compete in weight categories, the men are still lifting 30% heavier than the women. So if you created categories for height and weight, all you would end up doing is filtering all the women out, because everyone in the Olympic Games would still be men. So it's not going to work. And so it's another argument that would eradicate women's sport.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So she goes on to add, what about legislating without one single example of how this plays out? And we already know that there's been a couple of examples, so that's not necessarily true either.
Yeah, and those examples are the ones we mentioned, Hubbard in the Olympics probably. There's a few athletes. There was an article came out yesterday that mentioned 8 trans women who are all vying for slots in the Olympics. I suspect that 6 of them are probably real long shots to the point of no hopers. But Hubbard is one, and then there's volleyball player from Brazil. There's a couple of others, actually, who, if things went exactly right for them, might also end up in Tokyo. There are footballers now in Argentina. I read an article yesterday about a golfer who wants to compete on the women's PGA Tour in the US. So the examples of this are growing, which is logical, because I think the prevalence of transgender is growing in the community. I think 15, 20 years ago compared to now, I remember in Stockholm, we visited the andrology clinic, and the guy who heads it up said to us that they started, they were the one clinic in Sweden. He says there are now 8 in Stockholm.
Wow.
As in one, and that's over the last 15, 20 years. 8 andrology clinics in Stockholm, I think, was the number. And so it's quite clear that the prevalence is increasing. And as that happens, it will impact on sport. Even in the US, though, and this is relevant to Silverman, is there are cases of high school and college athletes where this is playing out. This argument about it's not common, and give me an example of it, comes up a lot. I had a discussion last week on Twitter with someone out of Colorado, Roger Pielke Jr., who was saying a similar thing and saying that it's such a small problem that it's actually not worth fighting over. You should just include it because there are literally only a dozen of them or whatever it is. Now, I don't know if it is only a dozen, but I also think that's a very bad way to run a fairness argument, because I think there's issues of precedent there. And also, I think it's...
What are you suggesting, that you should just allow transgender athletes to participate because there's not that many of them, therefore they're unlikely to make an impact?
He's saying, that's effectively what he's saying, and he's saying that if you want to spend time, and Silverman says the same thing, if you want to spend time protecting in women's sports, there are a dozen other ways you can do it. And there's no doubt that that's true. I mean, a lot of the people who've waded into this debate, I suspect, don't really care much for women's sport. They care about this element of it.
Mm.
But I'm not going to impugn their involvement. I'm interested if they're right or not. I'm not really interested in their motives as much. I find that quite... After this discussion with Roger, I found myself thinking about it. You know, like the world at the moment is facing, I think, 2 major crises. One is this COVID thing, and the other one might be climate change. Now, I'm a sports scientist, and I remember thinking after this discussion is like, if we apply that logic to everything, you know, that there are much more serious things that we should be looking at, What about XYZ? Why are you focused on this when you should be focused on like the big stuff? Then my entire life is meaningless. No? It's so stupid to argue.
Anyway, I'm care about two things.
That's I'm diverging a little bit here to say that, and the thing is that this issue matters enough to enough people. Mm. We heard it as well in the rugby argument, by the way. They said there's only going to be six or seven in England. Mm. We say, well, it's not six or seven. It's in the safety argument, it's potentially everyone who plays against them. So yeah. It's actually hundreds.
Yeah.
And in this instance, if you start talking about unfairness, one athlete takes a place out of a team from another athlete. That could affect 20 people.
Yeah.
Because any one of those 20 might have been vying for that. So it scales pretty quickly, I think.
But just I suppose it can get out of hand down the line. And once you start opening it up, then more potentially transgender people could come through the ranks because they see an opportunity.
That's the precedence argument for it, exactly. And so, I think those arguing for allow it until it becomes a problem understand that once you let the genie out the bottle, it's much more difficult to put it back in.
Definitely.
So what they would want to do is they'd want to open it up now, and then by 2028, when there are 40 candidates for the Olympic Games, they'll say, well, you can't undo it. Show me compelling evidence that this is unfair. Well, anyway, so this argument about it's scarce and therefore it should be allowed, and it's not a big issue, so you guys are all just bigoted for complaining about it. You should rather go look at doping or funding and equal pay for women in sport. Those issues matter massively, of course. Mm. But this seems like peak whataboutery to me, and it's a fairly insulting argument apply it to other things.
Silverman
in life
has
as well.
A go, and she starts talking about the fact that it's transphobia. Essentially, I mean, it's what you're saying in all this debate and the ones we've done before is that this is all about fairness for women's sport. Really, that's what it comes down to. I mean, it's as much about protecting women's sport, but it's also about fairness. And people always think this is unfair. In fact, it is about making it fair.
Yes, because you see, the difference is your perception of this now, well, and before, not
it's
now.
It's unfair for a few people.
Is that you recognize that there are different parties affected by it.
Yeah.
And so see the difference is she hasn't recognized that there are other people.
Mm.
She's only seeing it from a trans perspective. She's unable to see a different perspective on this. Mm. You know, take the coin out and look at it on both sides and say, actually, no, these are not the same. Because until you can do that, you don't see this as a colliding rights issue.
Mm.
And so her only prerogative is inclusion. She doesn't realize that in sport, and this is why it's a colliding rights issue, by the way, is because inclusion means exclusion.
Yeah.
Because sport is a zero-sum game. Generally speaking, there's one Olympic medal, and my place on that podium means you can't have it.
Mm.
Selection into teams is exactly the same thing. 11 slots on a soccer team, or 15 in the squad, whatever it is. And then, of course, inclusion might also mean safety. So these are the reasons that it becomes a colliding rights issue. And if you start thinking about sports like rugby, karate, kickboxing, boxing, speaking of, British Kickboxing had a campaign last week where they're actually actively looking to get trans women into British kickboxing. Are you guys nuts? Because now you're inviting people who've got this biological male advantage.
Mm.
And a lot of them might come in and they might be relatively weak biological males fighting against good females. You won't notice that difference. It would be like me riding with Annemiek van Vleuten. I'm still losing. But if there comes along a case of a biological male in the top 5% of that sport, that represents a massive physical risk in kickboxing. I mean, can you imagine? You're effectively sanctioning male-female violence.
I mean, there must be some legal ramifications if they allow this to happen.
That's exactly what I was getting at. And the legal advice that we got was that there are potential issues around acceptance of risk, because people walk onto a rugby field or into the boxing ring, whatever it is, understanding that there's some degree of risk, but they believe that that risk is being managed to an acceptable level. And one of the things that you cannot consent to is the possibility that you might now go and fight a biological male. How do you possibly consent to that if it's allowable and allowed in this way? And that's a massive issue for the collision sports and the contact sports. I mean, the combat sports, it's a humongous issue. So that becomes an issue as well. And so you're quite right. If you see this as colliding rights and you're a reasonable person, then you would very quickly ask, well, is this fair for everyone? No. Do I care? Maybe. maybe I don't. Maybe I only care about trans athletes, in which case Sarah Silverman's your person. Mm-hmm. If you care about women in this debate, biological females, then I think you've got to start saying, okay, they deserve a closed space. They deserve a protections that sports should afford space, to them, safety and opportunity, equal opportunity. There's legal precedent for this. Title IX in the US is a legislation that gives women equal opportunity. That's now being contested, obviously, because of these cases. In England, for instance, there's a Gender Recognition Act, which also allows for discrimination on the basis of sex, where sex is a powerful factor affecting that function, and sport is one of those. So there are legal vehicles also in play here. I'm nobody's idea of a legal expert, but that's the point here. And it's so frustrating when someone's first response is you're transphobic, because A, they haven't recognized the wholeness of the issue. B, they've lacked the ability to see a step out and see another perspective. And then C, it shuts the debate down right away, because they're obviously not interested in thinking about it. And there are quite important things to think about here.
So just to take it to the next level, we've got a couple more sound bites to play, because both of them are quite relevant to our debate today. One of them is Veronica Ivey, who was being interviewed on CNN, and she takes quite an extreme view on this debate.
That those born male have a natural physiological advantage that also includes differing levels of testosterone. You know the argument. Your response to that is what?
Yeah, it's a nonsense argument. So depends on how much time you want to let me get into the weeds, because I can literally spend hours on this.
About 30 seconds?
Yeah. So the first thing is, testosterone, your natural internally produced endogenous testosterone, has zero impact on your athletic performance. And we know that. But we didn't know that until 2013. Because everyone just assumed that, well, testosterone is why men are bigger, stronger, faster. But when we finally studied it, there's no relationship between natural testosterone and performance. So why is testosterone banned? Well, every body produces a different amount. And when you add to it through exogenous means, doping, there is a performance advantage. But when you take a body's natural amount and you drop below it, there tends to be a performance disadvantage. For example, in one study, they found in this elite set of male athletes, some men below the women's average for testosterone were competing at no competitive disadvantage with men that had 40 times as much testosterone.
So that was Veronica Ivey, who became the first transgender world champion in Masters Track Cycling in the 35 to 39 age group category. And I think what she's suggesting there, and if I'm understanding her correctly, is that she's suggesting that testosterone, you did touch on this a bit at the start of this podcast, that testosterone is not a measure of performance, therefore a transgender athlete doesn't have an advantage.
Yeah, pretty much. It's 2018 when she won that title as Rachel McKinnon, changed her name, I'm not sure why. But she's become the most outspoken activist in support of the idea of inclusion in women's sport purely on the basis of self-ID and legal recognition.
So if you say, I'm a woman, you participate as a woman?
As long as you're legally recognized as such and you live your daily life as that. So she's on the extreme end of the inclusion spectrum, effectively, and is an interesting character, very abrasive, has caused a lot of controversy, just left a position as a philosophy researcher, I think,
in the US. She's a professor of physiology.
Philosophy, definitely not physiology.
Sorry. Philosophy at the College of Charleston.
Yeah. I can assure you that physiology is not her forte, based on what we've all just heard there. I'll get into that in a moment.
But she's not a stupid person, because she's clearly, in terms of her academic background, she's... I can't say she suggested, but obviously her ideas around this are controversial.
Yeah, her thesis was on like basically effectively lying, her philosophy of telling not the truth. But anyway, that's a subject for another time. So the reason that the question, so this was on CNN, a show called Smirconish, and he asks this question about testosterone. The reason that question matters is because hopefully early in this podcast, everyone was brought along this understanding with us that the reason women's sport has to exist is because there is a group of humans, biological male, who develop under the influence of these androgens like testosterone. And these are hormones that develop what are male characteristics. And they provide such a large biological difference, which translates into performance advantage, that a category has to exist for people who don't have it. This makes sense.
Yeah.
So if testosterone is the root cause during development of these performance differences, the sporting authorities, in their desire to be inclusive, and I'm saying this is a good thing, thought, what if we fix this problem by lowering the testosterone? And thus the policy was born that you can compete or participate in women's sport if you reduce your testosterone levels below, at that point it was 10, for 12 months. In other words, if you take away the root cause, you will reverse the advantage, and the advantage goes away, and now we can achieve inclusion and fairness. Now, I've already explained to you earlier that the moment you assess the evidence and you look at this from studies that are actually well conducted, you recognize very quickly that there is no basis by which inclusion and fairness can coexist. Would you agree, like from what we said earlier?
Yep.
Now, those studies are contentious. People can argue that they haven't been done on athletes and they haven't been done in the populations of interest and so forth. But at this point, there is no evidence that the advantages are removed, and plenty to suggest that it is retained. So on that basis, inclusion and fairness are no longer compatible. But and the reason this matters, by the way, is because once you understand the male-female differences and you understand that the policy exists to lower the testosterone, your single question should be, does it work? Yes or no? Now, the answer is no, it doesn't work. There's no evidence at all that it works. But what Ivy is pushing for is actually a bypass of even having to worry about it, which is interesting, and it creates a couple of dilemmas for her. So in her response to that question, she's trying to justify that this focus on testosterone as giving biological males the advantage is misplaced because there's no evidence that testosterone improves performance in the first place.
I mean, it sounds so simple to understand that. What I struggle with these sort of things, when you've got somebody who goes on a CNN like that and makes those sort of statements, it makes it sound so believable. Why is it, do you think, people struggle to understand this?
And that, you see, when she says that, this is quite a nuanced argument. And I call these people, like, these are biological flat earthers. They're the testosterone denialists. When she explains that and there's no one there at the same time to say, whoa, hang on a moment, you're actually being dishonest, disingenuous or ignorant about true physiology, that perception is now propagated around the world. And 100 people have listened to that and said, oh, I heard an expert on philosophy say that there's no difference in performance as a result of testosterone, so therefore there's no problem. The truth is that Ivy's being extremely disingenuous or deceptive in arguing that. When we talk about this issue, transgender women in sport, we are asking whether we are asking whether there's a difference between males and females. Mm-hmm. Within males and within females is irrelevant to the discussion, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in whether the 8 men who are going to run in the 100 meter final in Tokyo later this year are ranked in order of testosterone at the finish line, yes or no. It doesn't make a difference whether Usain Bolt has more testosterone than the guy who comes second in the 2016 games. Mm. It doesn't matter whether Eliud Kipchoge has got the highest testosterone levels of any marathon runner, because he's within a category of people who are all similarly androgenized by testosterone. Mm. What matters is Kipchoge compared to a female marathon runner at the same time, Jepkosgei.
Yeah.
And in the same way, when Ivy takes this issue and tries to deceive us into thinking that it's about a male-female difference within a category, she's being extremely dishonest. It's male versus female. Now, the best analogies I can think of here is if we looked at the Olympic Games marathon and we tested all those 50 or 100 athletes and we looked at VO2 max, VO2 max would not predict the finishing results of the Olympic marathon.
No.
The guy with the highest VO2 max would not necessarily win the race. It could be someone with an average in the 50th percentile VO2 max. Similarly, if we went to the NBA and we tested the players for height, very easy, we measure how tall they are, the best players in the NBA are not necessarily the tallest within the NBA. Why? Because everyone's tall. It's already been selected out of the general population. Similarly, in the Olympic marathon, everyone has a high VO2 max. It's already been selected out. So therefore, it loses its predictive value within that narrow population. So there's a range issue going on here. So when Ivy tries to convince us that there's no effect of testosterone in males and in females, she is making a very basic mistake, which I can only think is deliberate, of ignoring the fact that that male population is already androgenized and the female population already is not. And so there would be no expectation that testosterone makes a difference anyway. Mm. What you should ask is whether the male compared to the female looks different. And then the answer is massively.
Yeah. So the final clip we got is from a Megyn Kelly Show, which is a very well-known podcast in the States. She's an American journalist, lawyer, political commentator, talk show host, and she was on Fox News for a number of years. And this is one of the interviews that she did recently.
Their lawyers have said in the lawsuit, look, neither Terry nor Andrea is undefeated, and neither have dominant race times among high school girls nationally. You know, that they're beatable by the right girl, cis girl, you know, born a girl and identifies as a girl her whole life. By the right girl, they're beatable. So what do you make of that?
I just think that, you know, if you see these races, you see videos of biological males running against us, you can just see that they're so far ahead of us and that the majority of us just can't reach their times. And one time that Chelsea did beat one of the transgender athletes, it's because the athlete with the top time got disqualified because of a false start. So it was only fair because the athlete wasn't allowed to run in the race and she was only able to win. And she lost so many titles and so many chances to get the spot that she deserved.
So I guess when you listen to that clip, it's talking specifically, she's talking to, you'll obviously explain it yourself, but she's suggesting that if transgender athletes were such an advantage, that they'd be, all the champions would be transgender athletes. That's essentially what she's suggesting.
Yeah, and so this is an argument about the absence of their existence in sport proves that there's an absence of an advantage. And in this particular incident or clip, she's talking to one of the now college athletes in Connecticut, who is one of the plaintiffs in a lawsuit in that state to try and have transgender athletes regulated from not participating in girls' sport. And so this is a very common argument, is if they had this advantage, they would win everything. Mm-hmm. And yet you, a biological female, have sometimes beaten them, and other biological females can beat them, therefore there's no advantage. Now, I can't believe, and again, you should see how often I have to explain this on Twitter. I can't believe
it's hard to do that in 240 characters.
Yeah, they end up being like 60 tweet threads to try and explain this. Yeah, exactly. It's frustrating. So let me give you a couple of examples. In 2007 or 8, I forget exactly when it was, Oscar Pistorius, before he became infamous, was famous as a track sprinter, double amputee running on these carbon fiber blades, which very clearly, in my opinion, were giving him an advantage. From the beginning, you could see that. But it became a big issue, and he went to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and one of the arguments he used in his defense was that if he had an advantage from these blades, he would be winning, and he wasn't. He was running 46 seconds, he was on the borderline of qualifying for the Olympic Games. And amazingly,
As an able-bodied athlete,
he wanted to run in the able-bodied
Because he was dominant in Paralympics.
Yeah. Winning by seconds.
Yeah.
And amazingly, Cass sort of semi-sided with that argument. They said if this advantage was so large, then we'd expect him to be winning by a long way. Couldn't believe it at the time. Another example, I'll come back to that, because what ultimately his story shows is the same as the trans athletes. Another example is, let's say you and I are cycling yesterday and we're going up a little climb, 10 minutes long, and you can produce 300 watts. Now, the best cyclists, and our mate Richard is riding 400 watts. He's going to ride away from you. If I gave you a motor on your bicycle that gave you 50 watts, would you beat him?
No.
Yeah, because it's not enough.
No.
Have you now proven that motors don't work?
Well, yes, the less the motor was more powerful, but yes.
Exactly. And so, you can argue the same thing with respect to doping, is you could take any guy that you just pick up off the street and say, I'm going to give you the world's best doping program. Would that athlete be an Olympic champion?
No.
Not necessarily. Maybe.
If they did the right training.
If you got lucky.
Yeah.
If you got lucky and you happen to pick a guy who was already within 8% of the world's best.
Well, it's a Lance Armstrong argument to suggest that he was the best. He was the best doper of a bad bunch.
Well, there's that also. So with all that factored in, yeah, an advantage that you get doesn't necessarily guarantee that you will win, because it depends on where you start from. Mm. So if I gave you a 50 watts advantage, you would still not beat Richard because you're starting from a base that's too low. If you were within 20 watts of him and I gave you 50, then you're beating him. If you're within 5 or 6% of an elite athlete and I give you drugs that help you by 8%, you win. Mm. But if you're 30% behind the best, there's no amount of drugs on earth that are going to help you before they kill you.
Right.
And that's the thing with the trans debate. And I know that this is going to sound blunt and harsh, but let me say it in the context of Pistorius. The reason Pistorius wasn't winning able-bodied races is because he just wasn't that good an athlete. So he had an advantage from those blades, but he wasn't athletically good enough to take advantage of them and become good enough to win. He was good enough to go from being a mediocre runner to being on the cusp of the Olympic Games, but not to go from mediocrity to dominating. If you gave the same technology to an athlete who was 5 or 10% better, then you would see that outcome. So the base level, the level from which you start, influences the level at which you end with an advantage, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I suppose the counter argument to that is that he did have some disadvantage.
Well, in that case, yes, there was a disadvantage at the start,
which you have to take into account.
What eventually happened is that the biomechanist called Peter Weyand out of Texas was able to use his modeling. He understood sprinting better than anyone else and work out that Pistorius had this never seen before ability to reposition his legs at high speed because the mass of those blades was so low. And he said, well, if he didn't have that ability, he would be about 11 seconds slower. So eventually they quantified the disadvantage. So even if his start was 2 seconds too slow, which it wasn't, it was one, maybe, mm-hmm, he still had a massive net advantage. So in the end, the right decision would have been reached there. But anyway, this is not about the carbon fiber blades.
Yeah.
It's about the transgender issue. So when we ask a question like, why are there not more transgender athletes? It's because those who are making the transition are not good enough to start with.
It's not all transgender athletes are world-class athletes.
It's simple.
Yeah.
And so if you take this difference, the typical sprint difference is 10 to 12%. That's the male-female difference. That's a massive difference. There are thousands upon thousands of boys and men who run faster than the fastest woman. So that gap, that 10 to 12% between Bolt and Fraser Price, or whatever it was, 2016, is 10 to 12%, and it fits 10,000 people inside of it. But that 10,000 people is still only 1% of the world's population. I mean, how many men can run under 10.7 for 100? Very few.
Yeah.
So until someone from that select group makes the transition, they're not going to dominate women's sport. Weightlifting, the strength events, it's a bit different because the initial advantage in those strength events is about 30, 40%. Mm. So now you can go from being maybe a little bit more mediocre, because as long as you're 20% behind the best woman and you make a transition, even if you lost 8 or 9%, you'd still be better than that woman. Mm. The sums make sense, right?
Yeah.
And so the reason we haven't seen more trans athletes dominate is because the baseline level of those athletes is just not high enough.
Yeah.
It's real simple, and it's harsh, but that's how sport is. You don't become an elite female unless you're actually quite a good athletic male.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, when we go riding, we're better than average, but like I wouldn't describe myself as anywhere close to sub elite, even, never mind elite.
Yeah, exactly.
So me transitioning would be worthless, but the guys who are 10% better than I am, they're close enough that if they did it, given what we know about biological advantages, they would potentially be in a position to dominate. So the scarcity of these cases says more about the initial level of the athletes who make up those cases than it does about the fact that there's an advantage. The bottom line is that you don't assess advantage as winning. Mm. You assess advantage as pre versus post, and how much did you gain? So if I gave you that 50-watt motor, the only thing that matters is, were you faster than yourself? And so in the transgender issue, it's like a little bit more complex and nuanced. The only thing that matters is you had an initial biological advantage by virtue of your male physiological development.
Yeah.
The only thing that matters is, did any of that remain behind? If the answer to that's yes, then it's an unfair advantage.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I'd say is...
No matter what percentage of that bit that remained behind exists, if any of it remained behind, it's an advantage.
Correct. Yeah. If it was 100 units to start with and it ends up at 20, that's the 20
that's the advantage
that the people you're now going to compete against don't ever have access to. So that's the philosophical issue around advantage that people don't always necessarily understand. And then the last point I'll make is that it's not always about winning when it comes to sport. It's about the safety doesn't care for winning. Because that's 30 people playing a rugby match, and if you know 29 of them are exposed to potentially undue risk. So, and then scholarships and high school level. I mean, this question is asked to a high school athlete, and so I suppose it's relevant because it's still elitist. But yeah, it's another one of those issues it comes up a lot, and it's framed as "ha, got you," because there's no trans athletes winning. You can't be right when you say there's an advantage. Well. Not if you understand what advantage really means.
Just to sort of round up our discussion today, what's interesting about this is that if you're listening to this podcast and you kind of get the sentiment of what we're talking about here, it sounds very logical. But we're seeing in the States at the moment that there are states who are trying to make sure that the sense and the science prevails. They're not allowing transgender athletes to participate in sport, those sort of things. Those states are actually getting... they're suffering the consequences of not having major events because federations are saying, well, we don't want to go to that state because they are discriminating against transgender athletes. And we're seeing that with the 2022 World Cyclocross Champs, aren't we?
Yeah, that's due to be in Arkansas, which has now also introduced one of these bills that would regulate or prevent trans girls from doing girls sport. The NCAA have said already that they're not going to send big events to those states, and the UCI for their cyclocross is coming under pressure to do the same thing. So we're heading into boycott territory here, like South Africa.
It's becoming political, really, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's long gone political. And that's...
Which I find bizarre that federations are... You would think that federations would be the ones wanting to protect the integrity of the sport they're promoting, than the governments, actually. We think it'd be the other way around.
Yeah, and I don't know how we got to this point. As I said to you earlier, like 8-9 years ago, I probably would have said, no, inclusion is fine because I believe you can achieve inclusion without compromising fairness. Now I'm informed and I don't think that you can. I'm still open to the possibility that you might be able to, that future studies will convince me of otherwise, but I can't see it right now based on what we know. But I would imagine that a lot of well-intentioned people early on made the same incorrect deduction. And they said, we can do this. We can include and we can be fair at the same time.
Yeah.
And maybe out
but
of...
But if you're in sport, you know that's hard to do.
Oh,
I mean, really, the federations, I'm amazed.
But remember, so they're coming under pressure, right? So
it's political,
and I'll tell you what, when we did the rugby thing, the social pressure and the organization of the groups that were opposed to our eventual guidelines was immense. Within a week of sending that thing out for consultation, the same talking points were coming at us from all around the world. And so there was this coordinated attack where they'd identified five key messages. They're going to criticize A, B, C, D, and E. And in the end, the whole point of consultation was to hear that. And I can honestly say, hand on heart, that not a single one of those five hadn't been thrashed out by us in the room because we knew them all. They're so obvious.
Yeah.
And we, you haven't tested athletes. There's never been a study on the athletic population. We had some pretty bright people in that room, and we knew that that was going to be an issue. It was the single biggest thing that we argued and debated. And in the end, we were quite happy that when you added athletes, the same finding would persist. But we still said we'd be open to it. But the point I'm trying to make is that it was amazing, like how coordinated it was, because all of a sudden from North America, Australia, New Zealand, England, and here, the same half a dozen talking points were being chucked at us, and you could tell that it was a playbook. And so there is a strong advocacy, and I think what had happened, it'd be amazing to go back to the 90s and early 2000s, is that women didn't have the same voice early on. You know, the IOC decision early on was made primarily by men, who I think are apathetic because this is not going to affect them. Men's sport is the open category. This doesn't affect men. And so I think that there was probably a degree of apathy there. there certainly wasn't as much understanding. Like some of the studies that I've spoken about showing the retention of these biological differences are more recent. And so you can forgive people for acting on what they knew then, but maybe not for changing it once they knew new things. So I think that there's, and then there's this, there is generally a social pressure to be inclusive, which I think is good. I'm not sitting here at all saying that we should deny people all rights. I just think sport is a special case, along with one or two others that other people can pick up and fight for. But there's no doubt that sport should be a special case where biological sex is the thing that makes the difference. And so now you're starting to see, you know, women are picking this up and there's pressure being applied. The politicians are quite happy to do it, but it does sometimes feel to me like it's a classic example of like a diverging issue. And that, even on simple things, this is happening. But now on a complex thing, you've got these two sides and it's like they're pulling on an elastic rope, you know, and they're just almost accelerating further and further apart.
Yeah.
To the extent that someone mailed me the other day saying that they're looking at making it a criminal offense if a trans girl participates in girls' sport. So that's ridiculous. Like, you can't criminalize.
No.
But that's the kind of like polarization that's happening. So I just wish there was more sense. It's emotional. It's never going to be sense on emotion.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
But there we are. So
it's been emotional overcome sense to some extent. Because emotion always sounds a lot, is always a bit louder than sense, isn't it? When you look at social media and Sarah Silverman and all the people who've listened to this podcast.
And incidentally, that's why what this debate probably needs is a handful of examples. So Hubbard participating in the Olympics is not good for the reasons that I believe, as I've explained, that's taking a place from a deserving biological female athlete.
But it will only really affect the zeitgeist of this debate if she wins a medal.
Yeah, it affects it to some degree through participation, but it's exponentially more effective if she wins a medal.
Yeah.
And so when
then the controversy will be highlighted.
Exactly.
And the debate will,
you know, with the Caster Semenya thing, one of the big differences, I think there were two big differences between, remember there was a Dutee Chand case, I think in 2015, the Indian sprinter who won the case, and then Caster Semenya lost the case in 2019. From my perspective, which was in it, the biggest differences were, number one, the IAAF really tightened up their argument. By the time they got to the Semenya case, their argument was outstanding. It really was very good. I remember when we got that document, everyone was like, this is actually a great piece of work. They finally managed to explain what the biological issues were better than they had in the past. They didn't pull punches like they had. But you know what really helped them was that the 2016 Olympic Games featured a podium of athletes with the same condition. And even though there's a chance that that's coincidence, it doesn't necessarily prove blah, blah, blah. When you put that in front of even like intelligent people who understand biases and that's a very compelling story to overcome. Because would this happen if it wasn't an advantage?
It's also easy for the general public to understand when they can see that in real terms.
Right.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, you don't want a situation where a transgender athlete seriously injures another athlete because she's bigger and stronger.
Yeah. Right.
And it's proved, because then, unfortunately, that's where the debate becomes quite easy to understand, really, doesn't it? And that's what we're saying, is that if you had to take it like that, an example like that, which we hope never happens.
Correct.
That's what we're trying to avoid.
That's exactly what we're saying, though. So it's almost like there's a precautionary principle in that sense, because you're right. I did see this a lot on Twitter when they announced Hubbard's qualification and potential selection. Is a lot of people said, great, I hope she now goes and wins it, because then it'll be unavoidable. And finally, we won't have to continue to tell people, but it is an advantage just because you haven't seen it yet, because now you'd have seen it.
Yeah.
And nothing convinces people like, you know, holding something in their hands or seeing it happen.
Yeah.
I really hope
they'll go
we
the
don't
other
see...
way if they saw that happening.
It's kind of majority. The counter argument to the Silverman. Where are these cases? Mm. Well, if there's five or six cases, then you'll be able to say, there they are. And then, of course, the big thing that would shout the loudest is the one we all hope doesn't happen, and that is something serious. But let's hope that never happens.
Yeah. Well, I hope that for those of you listening, that you've given you some clarity on this transgender debate, and I'm sure this won't be the end of it. I think we'll keep a careful eye on what happens with the selection of Hubbard potentially for the Olympic Games, if the Olympic Games happens at all. And I guess in the next few years, we're going to see lots of different cases like this that will come up and be debated. But I hope this kind of clears up some of them. Before we go, we want to just say a very special thank you to our wonderful Patreon supporters. And as you know, for most of you that follow our podcast regularly, we pay tribute to our new Patreon members. And I think Ross, you got them there with you?
I do.
Yes, so Ross, take it away.
We use Patreon and we hope that it helps us keep the ads down. I've been listening, now that cycling's begun, the Grand Tour stage of the season, I've been listening to The Move again. Have you listened to any of it?
I love The Move.
Yeah, except that like out of a 40-minute show, literally 12 minutes are advertisements.
Yeah, so let's just, I mean, for those of you listening to this podcast, I'll tell you what our philosophy here is at Science of Sport, is that we normally have 3 ad slots within our podcast. And the reason why is we could have more, but we don't want more because we believe the content's important to you as a listener. So we are very limited in terms of the advertising that we allow into our podcast for that exact reason. And we don't want to be the first 12 minutes of the podcast being full of ads. So this is why the support you give us on Patreon is so important. Plus, because it allows us to do this without encroaching on the content.
Plus, we don't have control over the ads that get put in.
Not always.
I dread the day that like there's an advert for growth hormone or testosterone.
We do have some control.
In fact, if you've listened to this podcast today and you've heard an advert for buying testosterone, please let me know, because that'll be quite funny.
No, we do have some control over it. But
I remember when I had I used to run a website, The Science of Sport. It still exists, but I hardly ever update it. And I remember writing a series of articles on doping, and I used to have Amazon ads in the left column, and I was selling testosterone on a website about anti-doping. That's the problem. So we'd rather not do that nonsense.
Exactly.
So we have patrons. This is a community that pledges donations every month. We have 3 levels. They are Olympic athletes, champions, and legends. And we've got a few to welcome this week, 7 in total. So at the Olympic athlete level, big, big thanks to Andrew Carey, to Jack Hambleton, to Ian Thomas, to Charlie Johnson, and to Joe Warren. Thanks very much for your pledges. Then we have 1 Olympic champion. That's the middle sort of tier. That is Hans-Peter Schmidt. Thanks very much, Hans-Peter. And then we have an Olympic legend joining our pantheon of greats. That is Gems. I think the name is Gemma. Thanks very much to you, Gemma. And yeah, we've been good since we committed to doing more frequent podcasts.
Yep.
We hope that you've enjoyed them as well, and we'll certainly try our best to keep up the momentum. So thank you once again to all those patrons for your support.
And Ross Beck, thank you for all your preparation for today on a very tricky and interesting debate, and we hope that you've enjoyed our podcast. But from us, for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.